You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM.
Well, welcome back to the Batuta Advocate radio show, going on week five, maybe six in isolation, recording live from the Budgie Smuggler bedroom studios. Yeah, still trying to socially distance, still trying to do everything right by our medical authorities. And I feel like Australians are performing quite well. There's been, at time of recording, there's been zero new cases in Queensland over the last 2 days. Everyone's taking it seriously, much more seriously than the Americans who think that their freedoms are being oppressed by doctors in Australia. I'm glad we're taking it seriously. And one Queenslander who is taking it seriously from inside his gorgeous timber Queenslander in Brisbane's Bayside is James Tidswell from Violent Soho. How are you, mate?
G'day. Very well, thank you. How are you guys?
Always good, mate. Always good to talk to a famous Queenslander. I think last week on the show, we also had a person from the Bayside in Becky Lucas,
Becky Lucas. And she's actually from Victoria Point, so she's deep Bayside.
But, wow.
What are you? Yeah, I guess you'd say mid Redlands.
Yeah, all I know is like I go to the boat trailer club and Ranger Stacey is always there. So it's a good spot to live, you know.
Now, tell us, mate, you guys have just dropped a very ironically titled album titled Everything Is A-OK, with the cover has an Australia flag, not exactly at half-mast, let's say three-quarter-mast. How does that feel right now, having an album that's obviously charting right across the country and not being able to tour it immediately?
Well, it's sort of like having the wind, you know, taken from your sails. Yeah, it's kind of like being winded, I guess, in a lot of ways. You know, you're all pumped up and ready to go, especially after the amount of time we've had off.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the easiest way I can explain it. I don't know. I'm trying to not think about it like sort of too much. It's just, it's sort of in a way feels like it hasn't even come out, you know, because I don't know. I'm not at the grocery store being, you know, having people be like, oh, you know, I like the album and stuff. So, you know.
Is that an important part of how an album is received, is how you're received at the supermarket? If you wrote an album that wasn't that good, all the punters down at the markets would tell you about it?
That's probably why it feels like it hasn't come out, because I'm wary about being online and reading what people would say about it, because what someone's prepared to comment on what they think about it is very different to coming up to us in the supermarket. So, you know, it's not what I base or any of us base the album on, but it definitely makes it sort of more real in a way. After this one, yeah, I mean,
it's like politicians. When you've won over the taxi drivers, you've won over the country. So it's hard to know if you've won over the country if you're not getting any cabs or going to the supermarket. Do you remember the first time you heard it in a cab? Do you remember the first time you heard it in a cab or in the shops?
I think it was Coles in New Farm, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, they were playing Fur Eyes. Yeah, it's a bit of a spin out. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge spin out. Yeah, because, you know, the music that they play in Coles, whilst, you know, sometimes I Shazam it, but, yeah, you know, you don't expect it to be played in Coles.
No, but it's... do reckon it'd be good for your APRA earnings, so if you're on a Coles radio at a heavy rotation, that's a public place, that's a real cash cow, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's probably all you can get now. Speaking of like cabs, that's all I always think about when they complained about Uber coming out and they were like, you know, pissed off that there was Uber and how it was destroying that industry. I was like, man, imagine if it was like exactly that, but Ubers were free, because like that's what we're, you know, going through at the time. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's not a competitor, it's now your shit's free, so you know. And they would complain about it, and you get in a cab and have them whinge. And yeah, I was sitting there like, man, what I do is free, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Ever heard of torrents? I'm going to torrent this cab.
You wouldn't download a taxi.
Violent Soho have this unique ability to convince every person that's heard your music for the first time you're only a new band. Have you noticed that? I guess it is because you guys perform so well at festivals. There's always going to be a 19-year-old kid in a crowd somewhere that hasn't seen you before because it's their first festival, I guess, and could have a lot to do with the energy on stage. When you guys first started making music, were you like a gigging band, or were you a smoking billies in the basement making music band?
Yeah, the second one. I mean, we still played heaps of shows. Like, I'm talking heaps, but never covers, you know, never, you know, trying to do that sort of thing. We were like, now I realize it gave us something that like a lot of bands don't have, because like we're so out of control. Like this is so beyond, you know, the realm of possibility of happening that it doesn't leave room to be anyone to not just be enjoying it, if that makes sense. Yeah. So, and I think that's because like there was like, while we play heaps of shows, you know, we were terrible. I mean, terrible. We decided to do a tour once because we didn't know what we're doing, and we booked a show every week. I know that sounds crazy or something like that, but we ended up playing 4 Mile Creek Hotel in Strathpine on a Tuesday night. And this is 2006, and the four people that were there started trying to basically, well, they started spitting on us because we wouldn't play Rage Against the Machine, killing them in the name of. So, yeah, no. And then they waited for us outside trying to roundhouse kick us as we like
went roundhouse kick.
I'll just never forget this lanky, big, drunk dude trying to do a roundhouse kick us. You know, but you know, things like that would get bands down, you know. Whereas when your ambition doesn't take into account not going through that, you know, it's funny. So we're just lucky like that, you know. If when shit's bad, it's funny. That's sort of the, you gotta laugh.
Yeah,
that's kind of the game plan.
Oh, we did our first national tour in 2018, and yeah, let me just say, QPAC in Brisbane was a bit different to the Gov in Adelaide.
Yeah, dude. Adelaide's good, eh?
They're fickle. Like, how many years has it been now? Do you have an official date you guys started?
Nah, we always try and work it out. I think what happened was is our first time playing was 2003 in a house just off Logan Road on Mount Gravatt, and that was where Henry lived. And that was in like July. And then we didn't really come back together until 2004 March, if that makes sense. Yeah. And that's when we sort of, I mean, didn't take it seriously, but we recorded, you know, demos. We handed out free demos. We played, you know, Fat Louis, Rick's Was the Dream. Yeah. And yeah, so it's around that time. So I think it's like 16, 17 years. It's pretty long.
So what was the song that really changed it for you, because you were really trucking along, if you're saying like 2003, probably be about 10 or so years until you really broke through?
Yeah, well, like we kind of got two shots at it, which is the most crazy part, you know. In 2009 we get, like, you know, signed to Thurston Moore's label, we go over to America, and I mean it takes off immediately. Like The biggest radio station possibly in the world, K-Rock, you know, we're 6th most played on there. And this is unbelievable at the time because Weezer have our new songs, Green Day has our new songs, you know, Paramore, and we're ahead of them on, you know, this thing. So,
yeah,
you know, this is 2010, maybe January, March, and somewhere around there, out of our minds. I can't even believe that, like, this is happening. And like,
yeah, because I don't think a lot of people know that about you, really, that you did kind of break through way earlier than what people here would assume, which would be Covered in Chrome.
Yeah, that song was Jesus Don't My Girlfriend, and I mean, you know, it got some play, but like, you know, it was nothing back here. Put it this way, the record cost like, I think, $250,000 including videos, something insane, and we we sold like 3,000 copies. And then we came home, not tail between our legs, but just kind of like, that ain't what we're doing. You know, it's hard to go from the garage to, you know, going on after hole in Texas. you know, Henry's got no shoes on. He's lost his shoes with his paw, and we're going on after hole. So it's just a big jump from Mansfield to, you know, Texas stadiums between Hole and 30 Seconds to Mars. And we just didn't really, it just was way too far behind the curtain for us. So we came home and, you know, heads down and bums up, and then made Hungry Ghost for like under 20 grand. And I think it's almost sold 70,000 copies, you know. So it's it was definitely covered in crime. Long story short, yes. Yeah, that's
I mean, I guess that was the one that kind of tapped a new era of Triple J too, because Triple J was changing a lot, and you slotted perfectly into where they were at. Because when you started, it would have probably been still a bit Miff, Adam Spencer vibes, and then by the time you kind of Covered in Chrome came along, you were completely what everyone was looking for.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, not Triple J, they were always, like, you know, pretty kind, and I couldn't talk more positive about them, like what I've grown up listening to and where it's at now. But we had so many years of people not like, but yeah, like bagging us out, like saying that we're shit, like, you know, that all this sort of stuff, that it was really weird, you know, to when all that happened. It was kind of like we had been so unpopular for so long that all of a sudden this stuff became popular and we were the first ones doing it. Not the first ones doing it, but yeah, you know what I mean.
Suck my dick and pay respect.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, dude. Like, honestly, the amount of reviews you read from 2004 to 2009, and this is truth be told, is like, sounds like Nirvana wannabes, shit. Then, signed to Thirst the Moore's label. and you know what? You think that that would just be like, everyone would be like, well, there you go. We know nothing. No, they doubled down, man. They doubled down. There is some reviews out there where it's like, it's just brutal. Someone asked me today, like, how would you describe your music and why does it sound like it? And it's like, man, it's because we grew up in the 90s. So whatever goes in is what comes out. Like, I can't explain it much more than that. It's like, we wouldn't know how to play anything else. And if we did, it would be disingenuous. You know, it'd be like, it'd be trying. This is what we grew up listening to, and this is how you do it.
Listening to old mate the other night on Spicks and Specs, old mate from Jet, who was saying
a similar thing to you. He was saying that album,
you know, obviously their breakout album that went everywhere, you know, CSI. It was on CSI.
Get Born.
Yeah. But then they said after that they tried their hand at writing a hit, like actually trying to write a hit, having debuted a bunch of hits that was just their sound, and then they tried to make a hit. And he said, "You kind of lose track of the world when you're trying to make a hit." Would you say that's a bit the same?
Yeah, I'd say it's more the mindset of doing that. It, you know, sorry, I got to turn the thermometer off on the smoker. Got dinner's here. Dinner's on. Yeah, I reckon it's more the mindset, you know, that you're in. If you're even attempting that, where you potentially derailed yourself already, I don't think it's trying to write the song itself. It's more like if that's the mindset you're in, you know, it's all downhill from here. The song that he's probably talking about is Shine On, which is a great song, funnily enough.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys are a sentimental bunch in that you still very much, all your family still live in the 4122 postcode of Mansfield. You do a lot of hometown gigs. I think you actually had a monster a couple of years back at the Mansfield Tavern, RIP. I mean, aside from the Texas stadiums and all those kind of big shows you did so early in your career, what has been the most special for you guys, for you? Was it the footy show? Was it NRL Grand Final or Origin? What have you done that?
We didn't play the NRL Grand Final.
I've just got a vision ingrained into my mind of you guys playing in Broncos jerseys. Where was that?
Oh, the footy show. Yeah.
Oh, that's the same as a Grand Final, mate.
And Origin.
It's the after party, man. Like, the footy show was like the after party of Fatty Gorton's State of Origin years, man. I mean, it was good. It was really good to meet. Obviously, those people were big NRL fans. And yeah, I just went full kit.
Yeah. For some reason, that's stuck in my head. I thought you were playing in front of 60,000 people, but you're probably playing in front of 400 yeah. or so in a TV studio somewhere.
40. It's TV. yeah, that's a tough one, but yeah.
Yeah, every young kid's dream regardless, every young rocker's anyway. But what is the most special gig, you reckon?
Easy for me. It was a place, I think it was called Brighton Social in Melbourne. It was like this like underground venue. It's actually at the end of Dope Calypso video of ours that for one of our songs. And that last show was crazy. In the Isle, I think, is the only song out from Hungry Ghost. It's like, every show we're playing is just selling out within minutes of putting it up, and it's 350 cap, but it's this underground spot in the city, and the crowd goes so ballistic that like they had to set up a barrier, and they put pallets, like pallets, obviously. I'm on Batuta. I was trying to tell mum like what happened. And so they used that as sort of like a barrier because obviously our paddleboards and stuff. Anyway, they got smashed to pieces, like kicked in. Absolutely, like the crowd took over the stages, people swinging from like the rafters, all like with all the power exposed and stuff, like crazy. I can't even explain it. Yeah, I thought that was just going to be as crazy as it got. And so that's why I remember it the most. But yeah, it was in the Isle tour. Yeah, Melbourne show, whatever place that was. Can't remember for some reason. But yeah, there's been so many, dude. Like, I mean, in 2010 or whatever, we did 208 shows or something. And in 2007, we played over 50-something shows in 1 year in Australia alone. We'd get in the van Friday morning, drive down, play Friday night Sydney, drive Saturday, play Saturday night Melbourne, drive all the way home, go to work on Monday, work 4 days or whatever it was, all of us every week. And that's back then. And you know what? We were so dumb, we didn't even enter that in the gig guide. We didn't even know what to do. We just were going for it. It was like, just get out there and play. So
how important is the gig guide? Like, if you don't enter yourself in that, is that like the be all and end all?
Well, I think nah, probably not. I mean, it's just it's the more word of mouth approach. But yeah. at the same time, like, I mean, that was the bare minimum you could do back then. I mean, that's an email to, you know, the street press saying we got a gig. But in terms of like promo and in general, I'm a big fan now of like, you know, saying that as I'm saying this, I'm just realizing, like, you know, we got billboards up around the joint, and like, you know, it sounds so dumb when you got that, but like, less is more. You know, I get that you're in isolation and your coping mechanism might be to try and do more to get people across, but like, when it's right, it's right. Just get it right. You know, that stuff takes care for itself.
Yeah.
So that's why, I mean, long story short, gig guide. It's by no means the be-all and end-all, no.
Yeah.
Now, James, one of your opening hits, soft opening hits you mentioned before was Jesus Stole My Girlfriend. Is that song autobiographical in any way? Is that a true story? Did you guys have to break out of the God Squad or something to kind of continue career in rock?
It's definitely a true story. It's and yes, we break out to... interesting way to put it.
Yeah, sorry, I'm making it sound a bit like Scientology.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's probably not as full on, but as a kid growing up, it's pretty gnarly. But yeah, we're all from Pentecostal or Hillsong School. My parents were married by Frank Houston, the pedophile in New Zealand. And then my dad moved over to start his church in Sydney, where I was born. And Brian Houston was part of his youth group, my dad's youth group. And it was a different church then, but it grew into Hillsong. So, I mean, that's how close I am to it. you know, my Jeez. Dad was a pastor. Mikey's dad, a pastor his whole life, is actually, is it called a theologian as in a Bible one? So yeah. Mikey's dad's full on. And then Luke's mom still teaches at our school. So my sister's a teacher in a Christian school. Both of them are all Pentecostal, by the way. Yeah. So yeah. And we all went to school together at a Pentecostal school in Mansfield, which it was called, Christian Outreach College back then, but it's now called City Point mm-hmm. in Mansfield. So, I mean, geographically speaking, I don't know. And it's actually spelled C.
It's a groovy name.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's spelled CITIPOINTE. I shit you not. I shit you not. It's like, idiocracy, you know, like you can graduate from a school that is called City Point, 10Ks out of the city, spelt like a trendy cafe name, you know, it's pretty crazy. But yes, so yes, very much true story. My sister, yeah, broke up with Luke because he wasn't a Christian. I don't really know too much about any of that sort of stuff, but that's the basis of it. I mean, yeah, you know, my family's pretty rad that, you know, something like that can go down and I can still like play in the band and
yeah.
Yeah, they do seem cool. All that album artwork with all the marijuana paraphernalia and all the
upside down crucifix, like yeah,
all the endless cans of Forex on stage.
Yeah, yeah, we did have to sort of not yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's a trip. It's a trip. Life is a trip.
So then you channeled all your spirituality into the Brisbane Broncos and just rocked out on guitar.
I was real young when I. When I loved the Broncos, I actually fell out of love for a while. And I used to go to a lot of East Tigers games back when no one went. This is yeah, no one went. Now that place is packed, but which is awesome. Yeah, footy, I got back into later on in life.
Now we're going to have to wrap up here and let you get back to your smoke, but just one more question. How's Splendor looking? Is it all set to go ahead? Has it been bumped any further?
Like, I don't know what's being said, but like, was there an announcement that it was like October, November?
Yeah, is that still all good?
That's all the info that I have. I mean, a lot has to happen in the world, I reckon. Like,
yeah.
But hey, we need something to hang on to. So, you know, go Splendor.
Well, yeah, personally, I'm excited for an all Aussie lineup at 2020 Splendor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I thought this was finally going to be the year that I was going to see Chance the Rapper. But I guess, you know, I'll have to watch the Hilltop Hoods again.
Well, you know what? Hilltop Hoods, they're always good. They always...
Always bring the party.
Yeah, yeah. You won't be disappointed. Oh, yeah, one thing about Splendor, though, they may be sort of having a positive approach. You know, NRL, the ambition level of getting that thing back and running again is... It's like the posters where people put up looking for a lost bird.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah.
It's a good way of putting
you gotta stay home, dude. You gotta stay home, all right? Your game ain't gonna happen. We're watching the Michael Jordan documentary.
Yeah, the thing about the ARL commissioner, Peter Vlandis, he kind of comes across as one of those characters in a Denzel Washington movie, you know, nothing is more dangerous than a man with everything to lose.
No, I love that. It's crazy.
Well, mate, all the best with the new album and the next couple of months.
No worries. Thanks for having us.
Hopefully, you can get out and tour it sooner rather than later. But if not, I'm sure we'll see a few Soho gigs on Instagram Live or something like that.
Yeah. Mate, I reckon I'm going to get into them. I've got to talk to someone. So it may as well be whoever's on the other end of this. Thanks, Ace, dudes.
Thanks, James. See you, mate. Thank you.